British Public Radio. Nature.
Brought to you with the Nature Publishing Group.
This week, magnetic switches could make your smartphone super quick.
You give it a little trigger if you want to send a call, and instantly it remembers everything that it had when you last turned it off.
And a new antiviral that helps cells eat viruses.
It inhibited the replication of several different viruses in cells, including HIV, West Nile virus, and chikungunya virus.
I'm Charlotte Stoddart.
And I'm Kerry Smith. There's an old Chinese saying that goes, "May you live in interesting times." It's meant to be a curse, and for astronomers studying our solar system, it cuts a little close to the bone. Some of them are worried that the behaviour of certain bodies is a little, well, unusual. They tend to assume that things stay the same over millions of years. But what if we happen to be living in a crazy phase? In a feature this week, science writer Maggie McKee investigates some of these interesting goings-on. I first asked her what got her into the story.
It was actually talking with a researcher about one of Saturn's moons, Titan, which is very Earth-like, surprisingly Earth-like. It has a thick atmosphere, there's rain, it's methane instead of water. This researcher said that he thinks that rather than the moon being like this for billions of years, as most researchers believe, that it actually just kind of got like this maybe within a few tens or hundreds of millions of years ago, and in another few maybe 40 million years, it should just become very boring again. And what we're seeing today that makes us so interested in Titan is actually not what it's like for most of its history. And that's a kind of controversial idea, but it really got me thinking about things and started thinking about other things we might be seeing in the solar system. And there are some other moons that are doing interesting things, like Saturn's moon Enceladus is shooting out geysers, and Jupiter's moon Io has a lot of volcanic activity. We might be catching them in a rare period of exciting activity.
So astronomers are keen on the idea that perhaps we're just living in interesting times.
Yeah, they actually tend not to like to think that we're living in very interesting times. They're kind of downers that way. They think that what we're seeing today is basically has been going on for a while. It makes them feel really uncomfortable to think that we might actually be lucky enough to catch something rare in the act.
Now, you look at a few examples in the piece. Titan is one of them, Enceladus and Io, other moons, and Saturn's rings is a third example.
That's right, yeah. They might actually be pretty recent, and instead of forming 4 billion years ago or so, they might have just come along in the last few hundred million years because they are actually so brilliant and sparkly. Researchers think that stuff should be hitting them, dust should be hitting them, and they should just be getting dingier over time. They shouldn't look as spectacular as they do. So that's one argument that they might actually be young.
And these kind of weird events going on in the solar system that may not be typical, do they mess up any theories that astronomers have about how the solar system formed or what it's doing?
Well, some of them, like the Saturn's ring argument, again, it sort of goes back to an idea of what's likely to happen. So because everything in the early solar system was flying around like crazy, it makes people uncomfortable to think that something like that could have happened again in the last few hundred million years around Saturn. They're basically backed into a corner. They don't like it, but that's what they're being forced to accept at the moment. But at the same time, you know, maybe that just means we really have no idea what's going on. So it makes them so uncomfortable that they're sort of willing to say, like, yeah, who knows, maybe we've got everything wrong.
Do you think that the solar system doing these weird things that bits of it are doing and anything going on here on Earth can be linked together?
Well, I think that one thing that we might be seeing at a sort of special time that we're lucky to be seeing are actually total solar eclipses when the moon passes in front of the sun, and you get this kind of beautiful ring of light around it. And that happens basically, it's just a lucky coincidence because the moon and the sun appear to be the same size in the sky. And of course, we know they're not. The sun is 400 times wider than the moon, but it's actually 400 times farther away as well. So they just happen to be about the same size, and you get the spectacular sight when this alignment occurs. But that, we're just lucky to be catching it now, because the moon has actually been moving slowly away from Earth over its lifetime because of gravitational interactions with Earth. So in another few hundred million years, they won't appear the same size in the sky, and we won't get to see total solar eclipses.
Maggie McKee there in Boston, Massachusetts. Coming up, instant on for your smartphone, and the European Union hands out a huge dollop of cash to a brainy project. First, boosting cellular tidying up could fight viruses.
Even our cells need to take out their recycling and rubbish sometimes. Autophagy, as this cellular process is called, plays an important role in aging and in diseases and infections as diverse as HIV and Huntington's disease. Beth Levine at UT Southwestern in Dallas told Nature reporter Ewan Calloway how she hopes to control autophagy and perhaps treat infection and disease with a new molecule.
What exactly is autophagy? Am I wrong to think of it like the cell's recycling bin?
No, that is exactly correct. It is a cell's recycling bin. It is really the only way that the cells have to get rid of harmful or unnecessary things inside the cytoplasm. So that would include viruses or intracellular bacteria, damaged parts of the cytoplasm, damaged mitochondria.
So does this combination recycling bin garbage disposal mechanism, does it go wrong in disease or in infections?
Yes, it goes wrong in many different diseases, and when it's working properly, it helps to protect us against many different diseases, certain infections, not all, but many, certain types of cancer, neurodegenerative diseases, certain metabolic and inflammatory diseases, as well as in preventing aging.
So it sounds like autophagy is something that'd be pretty useful to be able to control if you're interested in addressing all these diseases and infections. How do you do it?
Well, to date, there are no known pharmacologic agents that act specifically to induce autophagy. There are a few medications that are in clinical use for other purposes that can induce autophagy in addition to doing other things. The reason I think, you know, we're excited about our discovery is that it represents a more specific way to increase autophagy.
Well, yeah, could you tell me a little bit more about your discovery? Your team has identified and created a molecule, as I understand it, that kind of revs up autophagy in the cell.
Right. Our laboratory identified the autophagy protein called Beclin-1 back in the late 1990s, and we've been studying its role in autophagy ever since then. So basically, autophagy degrades viruses and bacteria that get inside your cells, and so successful viruses and bacteria want to block the autophagy pathway. And many viruses do that by targeting Beclin-1, the autophagy protein that we work with. So this led us to identify a very small region of Beclin-1 that is necessary for its autophagy function, but also is sufficient. And so then we had the idea of sort of taking that little piece of Beclin-1 to see whether we could induce autophagy. And it worked.
How well did it work? What was this autophagy-inducing molecule? What was it able to do?
Well, it works better than any other known autophagy. So normally the gold standard for when you do experiments in cells is to subject them to nutrient starvation, because to date that's been the most potent known inducer of autophagy. And it's stronger than that. in addition to working to induce autophagy, what we demonstrated is that it works to treat infections. It inhibited the replication of several different viruses in cells, including HIV in cells from human patients, and it also decrease the mortality of mice infected with West Nile virus and chikungunya virus. We also showed in cells that it could clear protein aggregates of the nature that are responsible for Huntington's disease.
That's amazing. So you've got this one molecule that activates autophagy, and you know it has potential to treat a range of viruses, some neurodegenerative diseases. Are clinical trials the next step, or is that going to be a long, long way off, like many things?
Hopefully not a long, long way off. We're actively trying to get there. There's some intermediate steps to make sure it's completely safe in animals before it could go into human trials.
Is there any downside to turning up autophagy?
So it is controversial. You know, too much of anything can be a bad thing. And there are some scientists who believe that too much autophagy could potentially be harmful to cells. And that would be something that would be looked at in clinical trials.
That was Beth Levine in Dallas, Texas. And now the best science from the world beyond nature. Here's Thea Cunningham with the research highlights.
Birds do it, seals do it, and of course humans do it. Now it seems that dung beetles do it too, navigate by the stars, that is. Dung beetles use a particular set of stars, those of the Milky Way. Researchers timed how long the nocturnal insects took to roll their dung balls from the centre of an outdoor arena to its edge. When beetles could see the starlit sky, they took less time and followed straighter paths than beetles with their eyes covered or those navigating on an overcast night. In a second experiment in a planetarium, dung beetles that could see a full starry sky took the same amount of time to exit the arena as those that could only see the Milky Way. The study was published in the journal Current Biology. Paleontologists have uncovered a fossil bird in China that, unlike other avian fossils, has large grooved teeth and specialised enamel. The finding gives some valuable clues about what the ancient animal might have eaten, probably creatures with tough exoskeletons like insects. Researchers pegged the fossil to the early Cretaceous period over 100 million years ago. Teeth like this, with longitudinal grooves, have never before been seen in a bird. You can find the study in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology.
Unless you're Charlotte, who's obviously listening to this live, you're tuned into this podcast on some sort of electronic gadget. And that gadget is actually a complicated network of transistors, tiny switches that turn on and off when a voltage is applied. It's a tried and true technology, but some researchers would like to use magnetism instead of electricity to run those gadgets. It might sound like a minor distinction, but as Jeff Brumfield found out, magnetic switches could be useful in new low-power devices. Jeff spoke to Mark Johnson of the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C., who made a new magnetic switch.
Why would you want to be doing computation with magnetism as opposed to voltages and electricity?
So everybody's familiar with the idea of a permanent magnet with a north pole and a south pole. You can take a little tiny magnet that you make with iron or nickel or anything that you do with permanent magnet, and it's going to act like that kind of magnet with a north and a south pole, but you can switch the magnetization from one direction to the other. And you can do that by applying a little bit of current. But the point is that once you've done that, it will stay that way, and that saves you energy. So with the other electronics, transistors, you have to constantly be reminding them of their state, and you have to constantly be sending these controlling voltages to tell them what to do. With magnetism, you can send a little current in to control the state, and then it will stay that way forever.
So one immediate sort of application I could see for this, if you had a central processor with this sort of technology in it, when you press the on button, it would just instantly be on.
That's exactly right. It's what we in the business of trying to make these magnetic devices, we call that instant on.
And that's just because it would remember, all the little transistors would remember exactly what they were doing, so they could just start doing it again, right?
That's exactly right. And so, for example, one of the markets that these magnetic devices is aiming for is cell phones. You know, you turn your cell phone off to save power, you turn it on, and it takes 10 or 15 seconds for everything to kind of come up, and you load some things from memory. But people who make these magnetic devices, we say, well, look, you've got instant on. For your cell phone, it's automatically off, it's conserving power. You give it a little trigger if you want to send a call, and instantly it remembers everything that it had when you last turned it off.
What else could this potentially be used for?
So there's a kind of a separate idea of reconfigurable logic. So if you have a CPU, you go out and buy something that has a Pentium chip in it or something like that. That chip is hardwired. But one of the things that we demonstrate in this article is what we call reconfigurable logic. So in principle, instead of having a chip where you have, let's say, a dozen different sectors, each one hardwired to do one operation, here you could have one sector, and you could just tell it at different times, now I want you to perform this, next time I want you to perform that. It's a different way of thinking of programming. It gives you some more flexibility. It can make things smaller because instead of having 12 different sectors in this example, you could have one sector.
So, I mean, it all seems to have a lot of potential. And I think one of the things that drew us to your paper from a news perspective is that it looks like it's miniaturizable, unlike, you know, a lot of sort of more theoretical materials papers. It really seems to have that possibility to be made into something small. Are there any sort of drawbacks or any big hurdles you're going to have to overcome before this can be out in people's cell phones?
Well, of course, anytime you take something from your first prototype, which is on the scale of microns, or in our case, 10 microns, and you want to build it on the scale of 20 or 30 nanometers, of course, there's going to be engineering hurdles. But our device uses pretty much straightforward classical physics, and all of the things involved in the miniaturization, each one individually, has already been demonstrated on the nanoscale. So we don't anticipate any huge hurdles, but of course, you know, as a scientist, you've seen many things happen, and you know that there will be some kind of problems.
Magnetically logical Mark Johnson there.
It's news time now, and joining us is Richard Van Norden. Hello.
Hi, Charlotte.
So you've got a funding story for us this week.
Not just any funding story, but a really big funding story out from Europe this week. This is a competition for €1 billion each to two projects funded by the European Commission. And this has been going for 2 years. The European Commission has had to choose between a number of enormous research projects that scientists from across the region have been proposing as the future of large-scale research funding.
So this is a lot of money we're talking about. Who's got it?
Well, the winners were announced on 28th of January, and the winners are the Human Brain Project, an enormous supercomputer simulation of the human brain. The idea is to simulate the brain all the way up from what's going on in each individual neuron, the way the ion channels are behaving, all the way up to really high-level processes like cognition and consciousness.
And this is the one that's sometimes called the Blue Brain Project, isn't it?
Exactly, because of the supercomputer that's being used to simulate this stuff. It's being led by neuroscientist Henry Markram at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. It's actually a very controversial project because many neuroscientists have argued that it's sucking in a lot of money to something which ultimately can't deliver on what it's promising.
Quite a controversial choice, I imagine, then, for this award.
Well, Nature ran a feature on the brain in a box, as Henry Markram is calling it, last year. And when he announced the details at a meeting in Bern in January 2012, one researcher said, "It's crap." So a lot of neuroscientists feel that the idea that one computer could model the entire brain and say anything meaningful is just a waste of resources at the moment. The computer power isn't quite there, and neuroscientists would be better off distributing their money into various different ways of modeling the brain combining experiments and modeling at different levels. Markram says, think big, put it all together, have a massive supercomputer, and out of it will come, no doubt, emergent insights about the way the brain works.
Do we know how he's going to use all this extra money?
Well, he's trying to divide his project into three sort of main areas, and one is on mouse brains. And it's all about looking at the brain on different scales, from the molecular to the cellular and up and up. And he gets researchers from all over Europe to contribute to a central website. And in fact, a lot of the money is used setting up the infrastructure. The other two areas he's looking at are similar data on humans. And then a third area is trying to identify the way the brain is connected and the wiring that's associated with particular behaviours. And ultimately, Markram is saying this will mean improved diagnosis and treatment of brain diseases and brain-inspired technology.
How about the other winner of this $1 billion prize then?
Well, the other winner is the graphene project. So graphene is this flat sheet of carbon atoms, just one single atom thick, that won the Nobel Prize for Manchester researchers in 2010. And on its own as a sheet, graphene is incredibly conductive, incredibly strong, and also flexible. And so there's hope that it could be used in anything from flexible, transparent electronics to computer chips that replace silicon. But at the moment, again, you know, some people are worrying that graphene is a bit hyped and should it have really got all this money? Because according to analysts, you know, there's a long way to go before graphene can really get into commercial applications, which this whole research project is really based towards.
How important are these two prizes in determining the sort of focus of European science?
Right. Europe has made a bit of a bet here that it's a good thing to do to get hundreds of researchers together to focus on a central, very directed research program like graphene or the Human Brain Project. And so the idea that you would corral all your resources together into one or two projects is something they're making a bet on, rather than putting it into lots of individual grants that spring from the minds of the researchers themselves. It's still not clear, actually, that these projects will get all the money that they've been promised. Of course, there's enormous worries that Europe is not going to be able to sustain the level of research funding that it has until now.
So those are the winners, but there are also losers. Who lost out? Who's disappointed?
One project was called Future ICT, and it was supposed to model human activities and their impact on global political stability, financial markets and the environment, again, in a huge simulation. So rather like the Human Brain Project, but for human behaviour. And that was done by social scientists. And although they lost, the feeling is that just doing the work to try and win the award was valuable in itself and has helped to create a community of researchers focused on the project. And the other project bids that missed out were perceptive robots that would respond to human needs, the idea of future robotics. And also there was a project on personal medicine, and perhaps the commission felt that enough research funding has already gone into medicines and future pharmaceuticals in other areas.
I'm disappointed those robots didn't get the funding. I quite fancy a robot doing my housework. All right. Thank you very much, Richard. All that on nature.com/news.
And join us next week for 10 things you don't know about ice and snow. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Charlotte Stoddart.